student in Ontario reading the book. I suddenly shut up, and they said, Evoy talks a lot, and now he's shutting up. There's something going on. What is it? So they quietly let the thing drop, and I didn't get to give it to the papers that the book had been banned by the English teachers, and I didn't get the chance to have every student in Ontario reading Fountainhead. This is one of the great regrets of my life, that only once I shut up and didn't talk. Thank you.
Thank you.
I wanted to explore the relationship of libertarianism, anarchism, Ayn Rand, Ayn Rand's attitude toward libertarians, and other such issues. One interesting thing is that John Hospes ran for president on the Libertarian Party ticket in, I think it was 72?
Yes.
And Ayn Rand did not see fit to endorse you, even though you were a lot closer to her than Reagan or Goldwater or anyone else.
I had been excommunicated before that.
Okay.
It was going around a lot.
I guess that was one of the reasons I left after I got to the basement of or the ground floor.
It occurred. I discussed all this. I had a two-part article in Liberty in 1990, which I suppose some of you have read, entitled "Conversations with Ayn Rand." So I almost purposely didn't include this evening the things that were included in that long article. But at any rate, to make a long story very short, I was on the committee of the American Society for Aesthetics to get some speakers, and so I suggested her, and she said, okay, you would know my work better than anyone else. Will you be the critic? I mean, everyone had to have a critic. So I said, okay. But a critic, of course, can't just stand up and say the talk was wonderful and then sit down again. So I thought of some critical remarks. I mean, I didn't think I overdid it, but at any rate, she really took it amiss and took it as personal insult, and that was it. That was the end of it. No more.
Yeah. Well, I guess one of the things that was perturbing to me in my experience at NBI is the vicious response to people questioning. You know, it wasn't usually hostile questions, but many just not understanding, and she would be very, very
You're putting
harsh.
It really too strongly. That was the exception, but it was that sort of response.
Oh, yes, that was the exception. It wasn't only that way, but pretty much every session or every other session, there'd be one. And
do you know, I don't mean to whitewash her, because I think it was a serious mistake. And one of the things it did was stop students from asking questions.
Yes.
They were afraid to, and I don't blame them.
The only questions they would ask would be very softball questions.
Yes.
There would never be anything that would challenge her.
Yeah.
Because they were afraid. It was a chilling kind of an effect.
I'd like to tell you what is a part of my explanation, not the whole. I think I discussed this with you the other night, but let me say it again. I am aware of certain issues in my own psychology. For instance, I should not have a conversation about the draft with anybody because I can't stay calm. I can't talk in a civilized way. I start to yell instantly. And the reason I can't stay calm is that when somebody says the draft, I see butchered young bodies on a field. But I feel like I'm literally seeing it. And my sense of the other person is, look, that's what you're talking about. That's what you're advocating. They don't see it that way, and some part of me knows it. But it's so clear to me, it's so self-evident, that I just lose my patience, my everything, instantly. I think that happened to Ayn, especially as she got older, in a great many ways. In the early days that I knew her, she would understand that since her philosophical ideas were in many ways new to her readers, they wouldn't she couldn't both say she was presenting a moral system which was brand new and expect people to already know it and not to ask questions that would imply they didn't already know it. But in some areas, she would see the consequences of some error, like I see the butchered bodies. It would be so self-evident to her, so obvious, that she simply couldn't put up with other people not seeing it. She forgot that it wasn't self-evident, that it did require explanation. And that's why sometimes she would regret later that she'd become angry and would know that the person really didn't understand and, in effect, had a right not to understand. But I think this was part of why she did grow angry.
I think one of the strengths of the libertarian movement is that we don't do that.
I agree with you.
We have questions from this microphone all week long. Some of them are very, very sharp disagreement with others. Bumper Hornberger and Leon Lowe got into a little disagreement, and I think everyone in the room realized that this is the way rational people are. Sometimes they don't see exactly eye to eye, and I'm sure they're still good friends, as I am with everyone that I disagree with. I think it's a very wholesome, scholarly, welcoming kind of attitude, and I'm, you know, just delighted to be part of this for that reason.
The first night that I attended an NBI meeting, someone asked, and Ayn was the one to answer the questions, because Nathan was in one room and she was in the other, and somebody said to her, "What did you think of Dag Hammarskjöld's death today?" And I guess she thought that everybody was a fan of the UN and so on. And she said, "Who the hell cares?" I can see why she said what she did. I would agree with her. But at the same time, here comes a man and his girlfriend, all unknowing, not knowing what this is all going to be about, and they get faced with this wave of hostility. Well, they got out. I'm sure they never came back. That's the effect it had on some people.
We eventually convinced Diane not to go to the question periods for just these kind of reasons that it was. And she certainly didn't enjoy it. She didn't enjoy losing her temper. And she agreed not to come, and she didn't come. And it, though Nathan did pretty much take her place.
In several different ways, I guess. I wanted to also explore the question of anarchism and also what libertarianism is. As far as I'm concerned, the Libertarian Party certainly does not exhaust the libertarian movement. The libertarian movement is a lot broader than just the Libertarian Party. It certainly includes groups like ISIL, which are not running for any office, and all those think tanks we discussed this afternoon. And my view on the anarchy question is, I wouldn't say it's a non-issue, it's still of interest, but like at this week-long conference, the organizers did not see fit to have a debate on anarchy versus limited government libertarianism. It's not really a hot issue, I think, libertarians, as just shown by the way the program was picked. Certainly, there were problems in the Libertarian Party in the United States, but none of them, to my knowledge, had anything to do with anarchy. It had to do with personalities, Ed Crane, Murray Rothbard, this one, that one. So I don't think that, to the extent that the Libertarian Party, which is only part of the whole thing, had any disillusion, it was over anarchy. And secondly, the Libertarian Party is very far from dissolved. I mean, Harry Brown, I think, might do as well as Ed Clark. Ed Clark got 900,000 votes, to my recollection.
I think he's terrific.
And I'm a big fan of Harry Brown. And he doesn't have the Charles Koch money behind him, and still he's doing very well. So it's a very thriving thing. So I think it's not quite correct to say that the Libertarian Party is falling apart over anarchism. It's not falling apart.
I didn't mean present tense at all.
Oh, I see. Well, in the past when there were splits and people would leave, it was not over anarchism. It was over many other things.
Yeah, if that's so, I didn't know it. And I'm glad to know it. Can I just comment on
something
you said about the atmosphere here of people being able to differ without getting angry at each other? That's one of the things I most enjoy about coming to these conferences, is the intellectual respect for differing opinions. No one is screaming at anybody, and it's a great pleasure to me.
I think to some extent, a lot of the credit, or at least some of the credit, goes to Murray Rothbard for that. I sort of see him as Mr. Libertarian, in many lectures that I've given, I've sometimes taken informal polls and said, well, who is the person who most accounts for you being here in this room? And overwhelmingly, it's Ayn Rand. But usually the second person is Murray Rothbard, and I think that to a great degree a lot of that attitude owes it to him, because he was very much open in debating and open to opinions. Well, in my opinion, he certainly was, yes.
May I beg to differ?
Well, my personal experience with him was one of almost utter and total confrontation. I had the experience toward Murray that many people might have had toward Ayn. When I started reading his stuff, he would invite me to his house, and I'd read this stuff, which was just so glorious and wonderful, and I couldn't imagine what this great man would want to have to do with me. So the way I try to impress him that I was worthwhile of being his friend is I'd viciously attack him continually. I see some of that in my son. He does that with me now, but
served you right.
That was my attitude with Murray, and well, I've been friends with him since he died last year, for since I guess
what?
19.
No, you didn't.
Wasn't because of me. I wanted to mention a word about the question about what is libertarianism and this lack of agreement on a not the axiom of non-aggression or consent, but rather the proof of it. The way I see the libertarian movement is that what we all have in common is adherence to or belief in this non-aggression or consent axiom. Now, libertarians have various answers if you were to ask them, well, how do you justify that? Some it would be religion, some it would be utilitarian, as von Mises, some it would be natural law, some it would be my favorite, this argument from argument that Hans Hoppe has recently promulgated. But I think there's nothing wrong with that. Libertarianism is a very coherent philosophy. It's based on the non-aggression or consent axiom and implications thereof. Sure, there are other interesting questions in the world. The Holocaust is an interesting question, as Leon Lowe was saying. We have no opinion on that. Chess is an interesting question. Was Mozart better than Rachmaninoff? There are zillions of interesting questions, but qua libertarian, we have no views on them. And I don't see that it's a weakness of libertarianism that we can't all agree on anarchism versus limited government, or that
no.
We can't all agree on the proof or the justification of the non-aggression axiom. It seems to be a strength. We have a division of labor, a comparative advantage, a specialization. We are a very limited political philosophy, and to me, it's not a weakness, it's a strength.
In my view, as we discussed the other night, is that it's such a serious weakness that it destroys the whole case, because all I would have to say to you is I don't accept non-aggression as an axiom. You have lost all power to convince me of anything.
Oh, no. Every libertarian would then go on, not qua libertarian, but as a person, and say, well, here's my justification. And you get four or five different ones, none of which you have to espouse, or any of them, indeed, to be a libertarian. Because a libertarian is defined as a person who starts from that axiom. Now, if you press me or anyone else as to where do you get that axiom, you're likely to get four or five different answers. But that's the way it is. It's as we were talking about the reductionism from physics and chemistry and biology, all biologists start with certain chemical axioms. All chemists start with certain physics axioms, and they don't probe them, because once they start probing them, they're in the next universe of discourse.
Quite true, but in scientific fields, they are relying on an accepted body of knowledge so that they can take as their axiom some part of those known facts. In this issue, we are not relying on, we're relying on anything but an accepted body of knowledge. In order to present our case, we have to justify non-aggression. We're talking to ourselves otherwise.
Well,
and even talking to ourselves, and I'm not saying that everybody is required to give the objectivist explanation. If it's a religious one, I would disagree with the person. But in my mind, I mean, that's fine if that's how they see it.
But would you consider them as good a libertarian as an objectivist?
No, I wouldn't.
Well,
I wouldn't, because I agree with Ayn that once you let faith come into your philosophical structure, it can hit anywhere.
Well, here
and
we
I wouldn't be sure of of the extent to which anybody was a libertarian who was also religious.
Okay. I have two questions, but first just a short little anecdote. I never got to know Ayn Rand on as personal a level as you or John did, and something that I would very much have loved to have had that experience. My only personal experience was while I was a student at university in Montreal at McGill. Twice I made the pilgrimage down to Boston to see her at the Fort Hall Forum. Got some books autographed, and it was really, you know, the thrill of my life to have actually gone down and see her in person. The interesting little anecdote is that, you know, the first time we went down to see her, I think it was 1970 or 71. I think it was 70. And after, it was an overflow crowd. They had people in another room, and I think that was standard fare at the Ford Hall Forum. They always had overflow crowds.
It was standard fare wherever she spoke.
Yeah. And after the talk was over, and she'd answered a lot of questions from the audience and everything, and it was over, then she had the book signings, and she, you know, people could go up and get their books autographed. And then after that, a lot of us waited out in the curb to see her leave. And we expected to see a great big, huge, long, shiny limo pull up, you know, for her to climb into. And here comes this little yellow Volkswagen, and she climbs in the back of this little yellow Volkswagen. It just cracked me up. I just thought this was so, you know, odd, but charming and endearing in some way.
Do you know, it was odd. Ayn was really not interested in material possessions. She could have bought all sorts of things. She could have had a fabulous penthouse, jewelry. She couldn't have cared less. She loved her tiny little study, which is smaller than mine. And if you looked at a certain angle out of the window and you had to practically break your neck to do it, you could see a bit of the Empire State Building. And that, to her, was wonderful. And she just did not care about things, about... She had things for years, things in her apartment that she loved, that cost almost nothing when she got them. But if she liked them, she wanted them, and that was it.
Mm-hmm. The two questions I have, one is, one of the things that struck me from reading your biography of her was her stubborn unwillingness to change a point of view that she had or an idea that she had, even in face of overwhelming evidence to the contrary. The issue I'm thinking of particularly was, for instance, smoking. She rejected the evidence that smoking caused cancer, even though it was something that affected her later in her life and possibly caused her death. And, you know, did she ever change her mind on anything that she had? You know, was she ever...
She changed her mind about smoking.
Well, she did.
Yes, she did. You have to remember the chronology. Mm-hmm. It was in the 60s that Ayn was very much objecting to the idea that it had been proved that smoking was harmful. And in fact, there wasn't as much proof as by any means. There was very little proof at that period. But when she was told she had lung cancer, she stopped smoking immediately.
Really?
The doctor told her they were connected, and that was the end of her smoking. I'll tell you something she didn't do, which I believe she had a moral obligation to do. She had a very strange view of her own cancer. She didn't want anybody to know. It was as if she and Nathaniel had often talked about the psychosomatic source of disease. She felt very uncomfortable about the fact that she had cancer, as if would that be seen as meaning something was wrong with her psychologically. Mm. And she wanted it kept secret. But what I feel very strongly is that since she had praised smoking in Atlas Shrugged and in Answer to Questions, by the way, she never said anyone's morally obligated to smoke, which people tell me she's supposed to have said that. She didn't. But what I think her obligation was to tell our students and to write in the Objectivist that she had changed her mind. She never did write it. And I think that was really wrong.
I'm curious to know how she would have felt about today's computer age. Would she have gotten a computer and learned how to use it?
I don't know, because whatever little typing she did was done on an old manual typewriter to the end of her life. I don't know if she would have gotten a computer, but I think she would have been thrilled by the computer age, that she would have really loved it.
And the last question I have is, Leonard Peikoff is her intellectual heir and her actual physical heir for all her property as well. And he's been doing a marvelous job compiling her papers and putting them out in books and things that I've always wanted to read, like the early Ayn Rand, all those. I'd heard about them. They were mentioned in the Objectivist newsletters. And I'd always said, geez, I wish I could read these things. And I was so pleased to see them coming out in book form after she passed away that I could finally read these things that I'd heard about but never been able to read. But the question I have is, who is her real intellectual heir? Is it David Kelly or that side of the movement, or is it Leonard? And what will happen to her intellectual legacy if, say, Leonard gets run over by a bus tomorrow?
I don't think... I want to say several things. I don't think there's such a thing as an intellectual heir. I don't know what that means. I mean, you can't will to somebody else your philosophy to know that they will carry it on as you want it to. As far as Leonard is concerned, this is something I really have resented. He has published things of hers that she never wanted published. I know that people are thrilled to read them, and I understand that. But she wrote her original short stories under an assumed name. Even then, she didn't want to use the name Ayn Rand on those stories because she didn't feel they were yet professional, and she knew that name would be important. She would never have wanted them published. And as the protector of her interest, I don't think he had any right to publish it. And he also has and is publishing material that consisted of her thinking aloud on paper to herself. She never wanted that published. He just had no right to do it. And another thing he did that upset me very much, very early in the game, not long after she died, he published not only things that she didn't want published, but material that he edited, which he said, which means that's absolutely historically valueless. How anyone dares to edit Ayn Rand, I don't know. But to do it, to edit her, means that's not what she said, or she said something that might qualify it or contradict it. And a historian will never know. That also is very wrong. Now you ask, who is her intellectual heir, David Kelly or Leonard Peikoff? If there were such a thing, I would choose David Kelly, hands down. Leonard, in my opinion, is much more royalist than the king. He is what a cult is all about. He and the few people left around him, and there aren't many anymore, are fanatics about objectivism. They are Leonard is excommunicating everyone in sight. It's a very ugly scene. David Kelly, on the other hand, has an organization which in my mind is sane and important. First of all, he welcomes debate. He doesn't just do lip service to it. He wants people to understand objectivism, which means they have a right to ask questions and to disagree when they don't understand or agree. He is also working on what I think is the most important thing of all, to get Ayn's ideas into the universities. And I don't know if you know this, he did something I liked very much. He added something to Ayn's list of virtues that I believe is not in any way a contradiction of her other ideas and is badly needed. he added benevolence and wrote a paper explaining it. Leonard would never add benevolence.
Thank you. Thank you.
I would like to prevail upon both of you to indulge in a little bit of intellectual fantasy here for just a couple of minutes, which I think might be amusing for the audience. But first, I just have to say something. The evidence linking smoking to all sorts of things was pretty well nailed down by the 1920s. The problem is that the religious fervor and the subsequent backlash of prohibitionism, tobacco and alcohol being very closely linked culturally, prevented much of that information from being accepted even by the medical community. I've done a little research
that,
on
that
this,
may be
but
quite so. I didn't
but anyway,
know it, neither did she.
That was just an aside to your comment about the 60s business. But Ayn Rand did quit smoking as soon as she learned she had lung cancer.
Yes.
My son is attending a school, and I've become quite involved with it, and the headmaster of the school is a friend of mine now, teaches a course in Atlas Shrugged. And so the fantasy I would like you to indulge in is put yourself in Ayn Rand's shoes, if you would, and ask her to give a 1 or 2 or 3 minute introduction to these children who are taking this course.
She answered. Oh, to these children. Pardon
right.
me.
High school students who are taking a course in
her
book.
How old are they?
High school. 16, 17, 18.
Do you want to do it, John, or should I?
I probably have to know more in order to be able to venture anything, but talk about achievement and the conditions for achievement, and that achievement is only possible and rewarded in a free enterprise type economy, and that's one reason why we absolutely have to have that, so that the best can get to the top. That's one thought. There's many other strands as well, but one could begin with this, you know.
I think
start with freedom and hard work.
Yes, she would certainly have included those. She also would have talked to them about the importance of reason and not to let anybody scare them out of their opinions. That she would have been very strong on, if they have really thought about something carefully and have arrived at a conclusion, don't be stopped by anybody saying, but other people don't believe this. Go by your own mind. What John said and what I said are certainly things she would have said, and many more. She was brilliant. I saw her once talking to a 7-year-old girl. It was Kira. And a 7-year-old girl doesn't have a whole lot of philosophical questions. But this little girl was enchanted by Ayn, because Ayn was talking to her like she was a small adult. And answering whatever questions the little girl was asking with immense seriousness. And it was wonderful to see the little girl started then asking questions was interested. I don't think that had ever happened to her before. Ayn had no experience with children, but nevertheless, she knew how to talk to them. She knew how to talk to high school students. She was a great teacher.
Thank you.
A few years ago, somebody, a Canadian, made a radio show called The Ideas of Ayn Rand, which was broadcast on the CBC. In addition to doing that two-hour radio show, that person also released something like 12 hours of tapes on which he had interviewed all sorts of people who had been associated with Ayn Rand. I forget his name. He was someone from Toronto.
I forget it, Jeff, somebody or other.
Jeff
Warren.
That doesn't sound right. I don't remember his last name. But one of the people who had been interviewed about Ayn Rand suggested, I think this might have actually been Roy Childs, and how he would have known, I don't know, because I don't think they ever met, but suggested that at one point during her life, she started taking amphetamines and became quite dependent upon them. And he suggested that this drug tends to make people paranoid. I wonder whether you know whether this was true, that she was using these drugs, and whether you think this might, in fact, have had some influence on her personality.
I know a great deal about it. She did take a pill called Dexanol, which has a little bit of barbiturate and a little bit of Dexamol. She originally started because at that time,